Good morning. This is Jeff Blankford with the November 23rd edition of Takes on the World, a program on international affairs that comes your way the second and fourth Wednesdays of each month and every other fifth Wednesday when I open the phones to get your takes on the world. Having done that on my last program, the morning after that fateful Tuesday, it is clear that the hangover, or if you prefer, the radioactive fallout from Donald Trump's victory and the election choices the voters were offered, is not only still with us, it promises to be so for some time. Nationally and locally, it has caused deep divisions between those who voted for Hillary Clinton, whether they actually liked her or saw her as a lesser of two evils, and those who knew her record and could not in clear conscience do so and voted for someone else or not at all. The divide, from what I've been able to observe, was largely based on whether one's priorities and legitimate fears concerned domestic issues, as opposed to those whose decision was based on which of the major candidates was more likely to lead the U.S. into another war. In other words, the former cast their votes for Clinton and the latter did not, since one major difference between her and Trump was that Clinton had committed herself to implementing a no-fly zone over Syria, which military officials warned would lead to a confrontation with the Russians and the likelihood of a catastrophic war. Whether it would have or not, we will never know. What we do know is that Trump and Russian Prime Minister Vladimir Putin have expressed mutual admiration for one another, while Clinton, following Russia's annexation of Crimea, compared the Russian premier to Hitler. Let us not forget, as the mainstream media and NPR would like us to do, that the annexation of Crimea and the ongoing crisis in Ukraine came in response to the U.S.-supported protest and eventual coup against that country's legitimately elected president, Viktor Yanukovych, in February 2014. Let us also not forget that it was the Obama administration, with Clinton as Secretary of State, that pushed the creation of what turned out to be the Islamic State, or ISIS, in order to bring down President Bashar Assad of Syria, and she did it, as she wrote in an email, not for the benefit of the Syrian people or even of the United States, but in her words, quote, for Israel, end quote. So that was a choice presented to the American people. On one side was a misogynist, racist, xenophobic bully with no redeeming social or human qualities, and on the other side, the most overtly hawkish candidate to ever run on the Democratic ticket. The number of regime changes scalps already on her wall showed that she meant business. There was, however, an issue on which both candidates were united, and that was their stated devotion to Israel. That has turned out to be part of the job description for every viable presidential candidate, although it was less obvious this year because it seemed, by mutual agreement, neither party's candidates were eager to be asked about it during the debates, and the media's moderators obliged. According to emails of Clinton's campaign staff released by WikiLeaks, she was advised not to speak about her support for Israel outside of Jewish audiences and the Jewish media, since it was evident that the party's younger voters are no longer concerned with Israel's welfare. Ironically, it is WikiLeaks and Julian Assange in particular who are being assailed for having exposed the machinations of the Democratic National Committee and accused of tampering with American elections in collusion with Russia, rather than pointing the finger where it belongs at the Democratic Party establishment for having sabotaged the campaign of Bernie Sanders, whose polls revealed would have done better against Trump than Clinton. So now we have the noxious Donald to deal with. How his presidency may differ in significant aspects than that of his predecessors with respect to Israel, and how it has come to pass that a tiny country, with 2 million people less than Los Angeles County, exerts so much influence over organs of our government at every level. Examining at 20 minutes past the hour, when I speak once again with Grant Smith, director of IRMAP, the Washington-based Institute for Research Middle East Policy. Grant Smith has been closely following the subject for a number of years, writing a half a dozen books documenting a problem that the mainstream media, as well as most of what passes as its alternative, ignores. In August, Smith filed a complaint in federal court alleging that U.S. aid to Israel since 1976 has been in violation of a law introduced four decades ago by Senator Stuart Symington from Missouri that prohibits most U.S. foreign aid to any country found trafficking in nuclear enrichment equipment or technology outside of international safeguards, such as the Nuclear Nonproliferation Treaty, which Israel never signed. That law was amended the following year by Senator Charles Glenn from Ohio, the former astronaut. It called for an end to aid to countries that import reprocessing technology, which would have included Israel. The recently departed Israeli former Prime Minister and President Shimon Peres, a co-winner of the Nobel Peace Prize for his role in creating the disastrous Oslo Agreement, disastrous that is for Palestinians, is considered to have been the father of Israel's nuclear weapons industry and was recently honored in Israel for being that. The nuclear technology he obtained from France, which President Charles de Gaulle later came to regret, while enriched uranium was stolen from the United States, a subject which Smith has written about and which we have previously discussed on Takes on the World. We'll get more into all of that when I speak with him later in the program. Trump's relations with Israel are likely to be different from his predecessors in one very significant respect. He may not have an eye or ear out or care what other countries, including America's historic allies, think of his interactions with Israeli Prime Minister Netanyahu and with other Israeli politicians representing the country's hardline settler movement. Thus, he is likely to fulfill a promise he made in a speech to AIPAC during the election campaign to move the U.S. embassy from Tel Aviv to Jerusalem, and he may announce that his first day or week in office. It would bring him an unprecedented support from the Christian evangelicals, as well as that segment of Jews, particularly the ultra-Orthodox, who broke with the majority of their co-religionists and openly supported Trump for president. All it will require for him to do is not sign a waiver that was included in legislation passed by Congress in 1995, authorizing the moving of the embassy to what only Israel considered its capital. It allows the president at that time, Bill Clinton, to sign a declaration twice a year stating that to make such a move would be damaging to the national interest of the United States. Every president has signed it since, but Trump, who has promised to do things differently in Washington, will likely start with this. A strong rumor last week that former Arkansas Governor Mike Huckabee was in line to become ambassador to Israel guarantees the embassy move to Jerusalem if confirmed. Among U.S. political figures, the former Arkansas governor's support for Israel and opposition to a Palestinian state is almost unequaled. As a Christian Zionist, he has made dozens of trips to Israel, many as a tour guide for other similarly minded Christians. Huckabee was one of the guests invited to meet with Trump last Friday, after which a presidential transition official told LondonDailyMail.com that Huckabee will, quote, be America's top diplomat in the Jewish state, unquote. The same official also said Huckabee was supervised moving the U.S. embassy from Tel Aviv to Jerusalem. That's going to happen, the transition official said Friday morning. Governor Huckabee is going to see it through, end quote. Well, if he does, we will very likely see a new Palestinian intifada, while the reaction of most Arab governments will be fairly restrained, since those Sunni-led are now allied with Israel against Iran and have done nothing over the years to assist the Palestinian cause. How Tehran would react to the news, aside from strongly condemning it, is hard to predict, but since Trump has promised to dismantle the agreement with Iran, despite the fact that five other countries are signatories to it, this may cause Iran to break the deal, particularly since the House has just voted to extend U.S. sanctions on Iran for another decade. That bill will go to the Senate, where it's likely to be approved, and then to President Obama's desk. Obama sees the nuclear agreement with Iran as a positive legacy. It would otherwise have been a history of foreign policy failures and would be likely to veto it, but who knows? While Netanyahu and Israel's supporters have expressed fears that Obama will attempt to push a UN Security Council resolution calling for a Palestinian state to be set up in the West Bank and Gaza based on the 67 post-war boundaries, that's more an example of Israel crying wolf than even a remote possibility. Trump has already dismissed the notion of a Palestinian state, effectively bringing to an end the lip service for a two-state solution advanced by Washington over the past two decades. AIPAC, Israel's official lobby, has taken note of this and dropped the call for a demilitarized Palestinian state side by side with Israel from its website. During a meeting at the New York Times yesterday, however, reporter Mike Greenbaum tweeted that Trump had said, quote, I would love to make peace between the Israelis and Palestinians. That would be such a great achievement. And that, end quote, and that his son-in-law, Jared Kushner, who is Jewish, could be the one to do it. Well, you may recall that early in the campaign for the Republican nomination, much to the delight of supporters of the Palestinian struggle, Trump said publicly that the U.S. should not take sides in the Israel-Palestine conflict. Such a position, however, is a no-no when it comes to U.S. presidential elections, as Howard Dean quickly learned when a similar statement that he made when competing well against John Kerry in 2004 effectively ended his campaign. Dean's abject contrition afterward for having made such a suggestion would later land him the job as chair of the Democratic National Committee, where he became a dedicated enforcer of pro-Israel correctness, and now, in the wake of Clinton's defeat, he has thrown his hat in the ring for the job again. Trump didn't bother to apologize for his remarks, since that's not his style. He simply changed his position, refuting the notion that halting the expansion of Jewish settlements was a prerequisite for peace negotiations. Trump then went further, calling for the continued building of Jewish settlements and even opened a campaign office in one of the more hardline settlements in the weeks before the election. 60,000 Americans are estimated to make up 15% of the settler population, and since they are allowed to retain their U.S. citizenship, they vote in high percentages in U.S. presidential elections. Trump's newfound unqualified support for the settlements flies in the face of the Obama administration's unusually harsh criticism last month of Israel's announcement that it would build a new Jewish settlement close to the Jordanian border, at the very moment that Vice President Joe Biden was in Jerusalem with U.S. officials and world leaders attending the funeral of Shimon Peres. The latest poke in the American eyes from Israel came in the immediate aftermath of Obama having agreed to a record-breaking $38 billion gift of U.S. weaponry to the Jewish state over the next decade. That's why Flint, Michigan doesn't get that money for their water system. That amount may have been on the minds, that is the $38 billion, may have been on the minds of Israeli-American multi-billionaire Haim Saban and the 1,200 guests at the annual fundraising dinner for the Friends of the Israel Defense Forces at the Beverly Hilton on November 3rd, which raised a record-breaking $38 million in tax-exempt U.S. dollars to benefit the soldiers of a foreign army that has not fought a serious war or been threatened by one since Richard Nixon was president. The major pledge of that event was made by an enterprising New York rabbi, Yekiel Eckstein, who contributed $10 million on behalf of another tax-exempt organization that he heads that I'm sure none of you ever heard about. It's called the International Fellowship of Christians and Jews, and like the Friends of the Israel Defense Forces, or FIDF, it chooses to operate under the mainstream radar of the media radar, and the media allows it to do so. At last year's dinner, which I reported at the time, the New York-based Eckstein contributed $8.4 million to the Friends of the Israel Defense Forces, which brought the total to $31 million, which was the old record. The Friends of the Israel Defense Forces is the fastest-growing Jewish national organization with branches in many cities across the country. All hold fundraising events, but the two biggest by far are the ones in Beverly Hills and on New York's Waldorf Astoria. While competing to see which city's event will raise the most money for Israel's army of occupation, both Beverly Hills and New York somehow managed to keep reports of their fundraising successes hidden from the American public, and the media invariably accommodates the FIDF's wishes. That should give you a good idea who controls it. An online search reveals, in fact, that no major media, print or television station, including Haim Saban, Spanish language Univision, has elected to cover these dinners despite the presence of major guests and Hollywood and Broadway entertainers. The last and only time the L.A. Times reported on one of the FIDF's dinners was a brief item on May 15, 1989, when the organization was 8 years old. Guests then paid $250 a plate compared with $1,000 they pay today. The article didn't mention how much money was raised that night, but did quote as North American director at the time, Lou Lenart, as saying, "It's Israel's USO, it's that simple," end quote. Is it? Then why aren't Israelis paying for it? Well, given the increasingly severe problems facing our own vets and members of the armed services, it is quite understandable why these supporters of Israel would not want their fellow Americans to know that there is an organization in this country that gives a higher priority to the welfare of a foreign army, especially one whose main task is occupying another largely defenseless people's land and humiliating them on a daily basis. The event did get coverage, however, in the movie industry's trade organs, Variety and The Hollywood Reporter, which, coming 5 days before the election, highlighted a bill instigated by actor Robert De Niro, a staunch supporter of Israel, and of Hillary Clinton, who refused to pose for photos with another Hollywood icon, former Governor Arnold Schwarzenegger, because although the aging Terminator had tweeted that he would not be voting for Trump, he had not come out in support of Clinton. "If you're not part of the solution, you're part of the problem," De Niro told the Variety reporter Melina Saval. Saval made no effort to hide her own sentiments about the event. In what reads like a press release from the FIDF, she wrote, quote, "The beautiful part of the evening was that people on both sides of the argument came together to support Israel with mutual love and admiration for FIDF, a non-political, non-military organization that proudly supports programs for the well-being of soldiers, families of fallen soldiers, and wounded veterans in Israel," I should add. It was only then, midway in the article, that she mentioned what clearly was the most important part of the evening and should have been in the headlines, the record-breaking $38 million that had been raised, quote, "to help Israeli soldiers and their families in need." And all of it, I should emphasize, is tax-exempt. I would say we know a little better now what is the problem. Finding the solution won't be easy. This is Jeff Blankfort. Thank you for listening.